Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. As most of you would know, the monastic community here are on our winter retreat, our three-month winter retreat, and we're 1 month into that, one third of the way through our retreat. And for part of this period, when we meet in the evening and the shared contemplation or the group contemplation has been around what is known as the teachings on the Ten Parami, which many of you will be familiar with, the ten virtues that we understand as traditional Buddhists that the Buddha spent many lifetimes cultivating. And in the end, these virtues or these forces contributed to the transformation of consciousness, which we talk about as enlightenment or liberation, the purification of consciousness. That meant that from that point onwards, the Buddha simply wasn't capable of operating from a place of greed, aversion, or delusion. The heart was, as is described, perfectly pure. And so, as Buddhists, we have confidence in this possibility. This is what we have faith in. This is what we trust in, that it is possible for human beings to experience this realization. It's not just a matter of putting up with the difficulties of life and then making the most of the good bits, but rather that we optimize on this opportunity we have and see this human being, this human existence, as like the raw condition that is something that we can cultivate or develop with the trust in this possibility that perfect wisdom and perfect compassion was the Buddha's experience. And here we are many, many centuries later still experiencing the benefits of that. So these forces of transformation, or the ten parami, the ten virtues which have been identified and emphasized as really worth focusing on, as I was saying, is something that over the last few weeks we've been contemplating together as a community. And part of what's really important about these virtues is that it's not always obvious their place, their function, what they are, how to cultivate them, how they function. For instance, we might think that the spiritual journey is all about generating energy and determination and having insights and contemplating wise teachings and so on, where in fact what the tradition teaches us is that There are these forces that I like to talk about as these hard powers, but there's also these soft powers, which it may not be obvious to us, it may not immediately occur to us that the soft powers are sometimes more important. Like the very foundation, the very beginning of this list of the ten virtues of the laid out is, it begins with generosity. And the second one is integrity. So the foundation of the spiritual life, as far as the Buddha was concerned, was not necessarily ardently striving with dramatic efforts to have insights and realize the goal. In one sense, that more or less looks after itself. What we need to work on is what we could perhaps refer to as these soft powers, like generosity. If we don't have generosity, then we move into working on determination and renunciation and effort and so on, these impressive, nevertheless important spiritual qualities. If we emphasize those before we've worked on cultivating a heart of generosity or a heart of gratitude, well, sometimes what's happened, and it sadly does really happen in spiritual life, that people end up contracting this tangle of me and my way, this knot that we all suffer from, this knot in the heart of an addiction to me and my way. If we haven't got a heart of generosity, a heart of gratitude, the whole thing can become a lot worse. And or if we don't have, for instance, an appreciation of the place, the function, how to cultivate integrity, action of body and speech, if we don't really appreciate how profoundly important that is, we can maybe build up a lot of energy and have great aspiration for liberation, and we can try to emulate the Buddha and try to emulate the great teachers and the great monks and nuns that have gone before, and wise, profound masters and so on. But if we don't have a real grounded sense of understanding of the place of integrity, again, the whole experiment can go terribly wrong. So contemplating these hard powers, and yes, they're very important, but also slowing down enough to really attend to these soft powers, like generosity, like gratitude, like gentleness, learning how to be gentle. Sometimes we get overly zealous in our efforts in the spiritual life, and we're going to conquer and overcome and achieve. And it's true that a lot of spiritual teachings are couched in what sounds like a militaristic language. It sometimes come across that way. But I don't know, maybe that's just the way it sounds like when you read books, because my experience of when I've met spiritual masters, there is this extraordinarily beautiful sense of gentleness and kindness that defines their character. So these virtues, these soft powers, these hard powers, these forces for transformation that all of us need to be working on. One of the things we need to be careful of as we cultivate, in things like in meditation, we're cultivating concentration and cultivating effort and cultivating mindfulness and so on, that we don't fall into the trap of clinging to them. Becoming spiritual is not the goal. Rather, the relationship that we're encouraged to have, we're talking about cultivating generosity, making offerings, cultivating respect, is one of trusting. Trusting in these qualities. Now, trust is a soft power. It's not one of the 10 baramis, but it is the first of what in Buddhism we call the 5 spiritual faculties. These, faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, discernment, these 5 spiritual faculties, satta, virya, sati, samadhi, panya, are well known and often talked about in the tradition. The very first one is this satta, which usually translates as faith, but for a lot of us the faith word has been kind of polluted or distorted and twisted, and so maybe it's better translated as trust. Faith is accurate, but trust is perhaps also okay. Confidence, I'm not sure about that. Confidence is more what comes as a result of accessing this faculty. We feel confident, and that confidence fuels our spiritual practice. But But this quality of heart, this quality of mind, that this facility that human beings have to trust is tremendously important. And so when we work on these different spiritual qualities, work on energy, work on mindfulness, work on concentration, work on insight, develop wisdom teachings, to also remember, how do we work on them? It's particularly for us in our materialistic society, where there's such a strong inclination to get and to hold and to own and to possess, and we make such a big thing out of my personality, my qualities and my problems and so on, that if we're not careful, we can spoil the otherwise good effort that we're making. And so one of these soft powers that we need to consider is trust, santa. To really consider it in our outer world, to consider it inwardly, to consider what it is, to see how it functions, to see how to develop it, to see how to protect it. So it's tremendously important. And it's not necessarily, again, like some of the hard powers I was talking about, it's not necessarily obvious. I sometimes think of faith or trust as being like the fragrance of a flower, that, like you've got a rose bush, the thorns of a rose bush. I mean, you can get that. The thorns are obvious. You can get spiked by the thorns, or the woodiness of honeysuckle. The woodiness, honeysuckle is very beautiful. And there's this, the very woody things are very tough and get blown around, but they survive the strong woody nature, or the vibrant colour of spring flowers, like at the moment, that are all coming out a bit early. You can get that, you can get the colour. But the fragrance, it's not quite the same, it's more subtle, isn't it? But the fragrance of honeysuckle. That's the big part of it, isn't it? The fragrance of honeysuckle. The fragrance of the spiritual life. If we could think of faith as something like that, it's very important, but it's not necessarily so obvious. And if we don't stop and learn how to value faith or trust or saddha, then we can lose it. So we need to really... we need to really protect it, to come to understand it, what it is, how it functions, how to cultivate it, and to protect it. To contemplate that it's faith that brought us here. It's trust. We don't know there's any point in taking up the spiritual exercises. We don't know that the Buddha had it right. I mean, the Buddha 2,500 and something years ago, and you go to the garden centre and see all these goofy-looking Buddhas, or even at Tesco's these days, they sell Buddha images, and people sometimes stick incense in the Buddha's head, and sometimes they use it as a doorstop. And what is it with the Buddha anyway? Is the Buddha, he was this Indian guy, and what is it about the Buddha? He's kind of popular, Richard Gere's into the Buddha, and so what do we know about the Buddha? Well, we don't know that much about the Buddha. We don't know that much. They didn't have computers in those days. They didn't even write stuff down, important stuff. They just memorized it and recited it. It was 500 years after the Buddha died before they really started to write things down. So who knows, really? But we trust, don't we? We trust in something. There's something there we recognize. There's something that's lasted 2,500 years that rings true. And so we trust in the Buddha. It's the trust that brought us here. It's trust that introduces us. It's trust that motivates us to pick up the spiritual disciplines. And if we don't protect that trust, well, we can lose it. And so it happens on the spiritual journey that We may have trust, confidence, faith in the beginning, but as we the heart knot of me and my way starts to untangle and energy starts to get released, it's not necessarily comfortable, painful, beautiful energy. Sometimes it's quite the opposite. It's very confusing, disorienting, painful energy. It's been locked away in our habits of clinging. Well, how do we sustain ourselves? Well, a lot of information, a lot of ideas, maybe is not good enough. In fact, anybody who's lived this spiritual life for very long knows that it's trust, it's faith that sustains us. And it's not the same as belief. Beliefs are perhaps something more to do with what goes on in our heads, concepts, ideas. But trust is a heart quality. It's a feeling, and it's profoundly important. To use another image, I find fits when we're contemplating trust. For me, it's like when you're learning how to float. When you go swimming in the ocean, and you're doing swimming, as I used to like to do, swimming long distance, and you get tired, what do? You just roll over on your back and just float. Breathe and float, and just the water holds you. But the first time you learn how to do this, well, we don't know we can do it. In fact, there's a good reason to suspect that we can't do it, because water, it's not like this solid oak floor we've got here. If you lie down the solid oak floor here, there's all sorts of good reasons to strongly expect that you're not going to fall through it. It's going to support you. But floating on water, how do you do it? Well, those of you that have done it know that you've got to let go of distrust. We've got to let go of distrust until the breathing becomes just right, relaxed breathing, and then, sure enough, the body floats. And the water does hold us, but it takes this disposition of trusting rather than what? If we want to understand the faculty of trust, one aspect of understanding is to see what happens when we don't have trust. When we don't trust in a relationship, but we've got to live with somebody, what do? We try to control. Controlling, compulsive, willful controlling, is what the deluded ego does. And that's what the deluded ego is really masterful at, is controlling, willful controlling, manipulating. It loves it. It loves to be in charge. And in fact, it's the pain of this compulsive, willful controlling that, for many of us, motivated our doing this. It's just so inadequate, so unsatisfactory. And so energy extravagant to always be trying to control life. And it just doesn't work. Trying to control the body, that's already difficult enough. The thing gets old on you and painful. Things don't work like you want them to. We take this body so seriously. This is me. This is my body. Look in the mirror and take photographs of it and post photographs to people. Like, this is me. And we actually haven't got a lot of control over it. You maybe, wash it and keep it clean and exercise it. But you can't stop it from getting sick. You can't stop it from getting old. You can't stop it from dying. So that's a failure. Our compulsive tendency to want to control the body just doesn't work. It's not actually mine. It's an aspect of nature. And the mind, our moods, my goodness, trying to control our moods. You get into a bad mood, and it's just thoroughly inconvenient to be in a bad mood. You've got to go for an interview, or you've got to see somebody, and you're just feeling really grumpy and miserable, and kind of try to snap out of it. It just doesn't work. maybe sometimes to some degree, you've got some willful control over it. And you might want to put a lot of energy into becoming masterful at controlling, but sooner or later, we're going to fail. It just doesn't work that way. Like the body, we can't control our moods. You lose somebody you love, and there's gut-ripping sadness emerges, even if it's somebody that you expected to pass away. When they've gone and there's this sadness emerges, it may not be convenient. You can't control it. Anger, somebody who we thought we could trust, betrays us. Anger comes up, and you say, I've got to get out of this. I've been doing all these spiritual exercises all these years. I should know better than this. Well, all this how we should be, trying to control, doesn't work past a certain point. But that's what the deluded ego does. Yeah. And if we don't have conscious capacity for trusting, then maybe we'd end up being a victim of this addiction, this habit of controlling all the time. And as we get older, maybe it gets more difficult. More and more denied life that we feel we have to control. And how are we going to meet it? Well, the spiritual solution to that is meeting it with conscious faith. Not naive faith, but a conscious faith, inspected faith, tried and tested, cultivated capacity for trusting. Trust has the potential to outshine these habitual tendencies of controlling. But this is not something to believe in, this is something to cultivate. And we cultivate it in our outer relationships with the world and also our inner world. And those of you that have our calendar hanging on your wall or sitting on your desk will have seen the photograph of our monastery in Thailand, Wat Nanachat, and a whole large crowd of monks gathered there for probably evening chanting, I think it is. And the quote underneath is a verse of Ajahn Chah's teaching where he says something like, because there's many of us living together doesn't mean we have to have disharmony. A millipede has got many legs, but it doesn't have any difficulty walking. That's a typical Ajahn Chah image to help us understand a principle. The millipede doesn't have to consult every leg before it moves it. There's a manner in which it all just happens. And Ajahn Chah is pointing out that if we have the right faculties in place, if we approach in the right manner, then even though there's many of us living together, spiritual community just happens. And one of those faculties, one of those very important faculties, is trust. We trust in the teaching. We trust in each other. We trust in the community. We trust in the training. We have, as monks and nuns, we have, as you probably all know, we've got oodles of rules that we are supposed to be familiar with and hopefully are good enough familiar with. And we trust in these rules. We don't necessarily see the point of them. Certainly when you're starting off in the training, there's all these rules, do this, don't do that. And what's the point of that? Well, if you try to figure it all out, it can give you a serious headache and be extremely frustrating. Whereas if you look ahead of you and see those who have applied themselves to the training and realize the benefit for themselves, say, well, I'll just trust in them and see what happens. And those of you that have gotten yourself trained in Alexander technique, what's the point of lying on the floor with your head on a telephone book? I mean, what's that all about? Other people have done it and it seemed to work. Well, it's not just the telephone book and it's not just lying on the floor. There's more to it than that. That's the form. But the spirit, the energy, the point, the relevance of Alexander technique is something else. It's something to be experienced. It requires a trusting disposition and a letting go. Now, similarly, living in spiritual community, it takes a trusting disposition and a letting go. Yeah. When somebody joins the monastic community, for instance, there's no contract. The preceptor doesn't get the ordinand to sign a contract or to pay money, at least not in our communities, to stay in the monastery. It's based on trust. And the preceptor will give the training to the applicant and trust that they will respond, they will meet it with the right attitude, with the right effort. And every fortnight, we come together as a spiritual community and recite all our training rules, and what the glue that keeps it together is trust. There's nobody going around policing the community, nobody checking up on. I don't go into everybody's room and see that they're behaving themselves, but rather the spirit of spiritual community, a profoundly important aspect of it, is trust. Yes. But this, again, it has to be emphasized, it's mindful trust, conscious trust. It's not a naive believing. That doesn't serve in the same way. So trusting in each other, trusting outwardly, also trusting inwardly, trusting in ourselves. There's a verse where the Buddha said, Attahi atano nato kohi nato porosita. You are your own refuge, or oneself is one's own refuge. How could it be otherwise? The Buddha is not inviting us to just trust in the teacher, just trust in the teachings, just trust in the community. But also, in fact, ultimately, these are to teach us how to trust in ourselves. Just like kids, ideally, have got trustworthy parents. If they don't trust their parents, they grow up in a state of anxiety and don't develop properly. And the potential for all sorts of beautiful possibilities is the deprived, because they don't grow up in a trusting, safe environment. Yeah. But children don't grow up with their parents and become attached to their parents, ideally. The relationship of trusting serves a purpose, so that the child can grow up and become an adult that is in a position to be able to realize their potential in life. And similarly, in the spiritual life, we have the teachers, we have the teachings, we have the spiritual community, we have each other's company to encourage us. We trust in this, but the point of it is to grow up and realize that potential we have for really trusting in ourselves. Now, this is not trusting in the inflated, exaggerated sense of self-importance that is the nature of the deluded ego. And this is rather, as I say, trusting yourself. It's talking about the direction of investigation, the direction to be seeking. We're seeking freedom. The Buddha wasn't telling us that the freedom is by believing in him or believing in what he said or believing in anything outwardly. The direction to be seeking freedom is inwards, in understanding for ourselves what it is, where it is, and how it is that we distort our seeing, our inner seeing, our consciousness. How do we distort, disfigure the heart so that it expresses itself with greed, aversion, and delusion rather than radiant wisdom and compassion? The radiant wisdom and compassion that was exemplified by the Buddha and all the great teachers, that's why we bow to the Buddha, not because we project onto the Buddha all our ability, but rather that we show in showing respect and showing trust to the teacher and the teachings, that within us that potential becomes activated, becomes quickened. But again, to emphasize, we're trusting that potential, all these forces, whether it's the hard powers or the soft powers, generosity, gratitude, kindness, trusting in these forces, not becoming them, not clinging to them. And the trust gets purified, hopefully, as we go along. Yeah. For some of us, all this talk about trust and faith, it kind of leaves us a bit flat. But for some people, sadly, the faculty of trust gets damaged early on in life. If you're betrayed by those who we thought we could trust at the wrong time, in the wrong way, it can leave serious wounding. And before we can progress in life, in any dimension, certainly in the spiritual dimension, before we can progress very far, it's essential that we address this faculty, the ability to trust. It's trust that enables letting go. Willful controlling is an expression of clinging, of distrust. And if we've seen the futility of that, and we want to experience letting go, then it's really important that we cultivate this. And so if we are somebody who has experienced that kind of wounding, for many it happens on the level of religion, where you're sold some bad stories in the name of religion and you feel betrayed, and if you're not careful, you can not attend to that painful wounding and close the door on that possibility. And for many people, they do. They close the door on the possibility of spiritual development and seek fulfillment, seek contentment in things that are inherently unsatisfactory and other false stories. So the wise thing to do is, if we hear these teachings, the possibility of realization of perfect wisdom, perfect compassion, and that rings true to us for whatever reason, and then we engage the capacity for trusting in it, not believing in it, not just clinging to it, but trusting in it and letting that be a guiding force in our lives. And if we do find it difficult, then yes, to find, how do you heal distrust? Now, one of the ways that all of us will have some experience in it is loving kindness. Yeah. Loving kindness heals the wound of betrayal. If we get caught up in resentment and bitterness, then it just makes the wound worse. But if we hear the teachings on the potential for healing such a wound, and there's betrayal, distrust, and then engage it in a skillful, careful, mindful, sensitive way, maybe we come to find out for ourselves that we can grow out of what is a perfectly understandable attitude for children, which is, I need to be loved. Yeah. I need to be recognized. I need to be appreciated. There's absolutely a stage where children go through where that's important, that's how it is. But for adults, I need to be loving. I need to express appreciation. I need to express gratitude. That's what I actually need. I need to, because in the expression of being loving, of being generous, of being grateful, and exercising that ability, we get in touch with the potential within ourselves. So long as we dwell on the idea, I need somebody to love me to make me whole, or I need somebody to appreciate me to make me feel good about my life, we're exercising the view that we're somehow inherently inadequate. And you can have that view, but it's not a very good one. It doesn't end up making you feel very good. And you might end up, you know, being used. You know, there's a lot of people marketing things that purport to gratify those longings. Yeah. But if we engage the teachings in a mindful, skillful, trusting manner, maybe we come to realize that loving kindness heals. Forgiveness is a possibility when we experience how to trust and letting go of resentment. Old pain, old hurt, doesn't mean to say we're going to forget it, but we don't have to keep investing resentment and bitterness into that memory. So contemplating in our own way, finding our own pathway, our own direction, but whatever approach we take, coming to a personal appreciation of the place of this soft power of trust, of faith, of saddha. It's not the goal in the sense that, well, certainly not the initial faith or trust that we have in practice that brought us here. That's not the goal. It's important. But the goal is, as I'm mentioning those five spiritual faculties that many of you will know about, faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and discernment or wisdom, is see that faith on one hand is in opposition to wisdom or discernment, insight. That's the goal. Understanding is the goal. Realization is the goal. And this faith on one side and wisdom on the other side, they work together. So one of the teachings that Ajahn Chah gave that I came across very early on, where he was talking about faith. And he talked about the three different types of faith. There's the initial faith, which is actually kind of spurious, and in a way you can get into arguments on that level. But then when we practice, when we're motivated and we engage it and we work on the basis of that trusting relationship to the Dhamma, and then there's some verification, and faith takes on another expression. So there's the initial faith, then there's verified faith, and then he said that the nature of the awakened mind is also living out of faith, living out of trust. It's not that awakened beings have got their heads and hearts stuffed full of all sorts of information about everything, but basically because they've seen reality, because they've realized clear seeing, they just have a trusting relationship to everything, which puts them into a harmonious relationship with everything. So thank you very much this evening for your attention.
Kandamayang dhamma vadakata sadhukarang dhamma se sa